From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Arthur Hertzberg, author of the new book, The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. Hertzberg won a National Jewish Book Award this year for his memoir, A Jew in America. He's the former president of the American Jewish Congress. Also, we talk with Dr. Eric Gomar of Doctors Without Borders. He started a pilot project in a poor South African township where his staff gives antiretroviral drugs to people with AIDS. When he started the program, the South African government refused to provide access to these drugs, challenging their effectiveness, even challenging whether HIV causes AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court has found that key parts of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law are constitutional. On a vote of 5-4, the court found that Congress does have the authority to ban unregulated contributions to political parties and to ban some political ads during the final weeks of campaigns. Professor Paul Hernson heads the Center for American Politics and Citizenship at the University of Maryland. He says the law won't cure all campaign finance problems.
There's always a law passed, and then eventually people do find ways to get around it. Hopefully, as those kinds of weaknesses in the law are disclosed, further reform will be advanced.
Regulations based on the McCain-Feingold law have been in effect for the early stages of the 2004 presidential and congressional campaigns. There's anger and confusion in countries excluded from the Pentagon's list of nations eligible for billions of dollars worth of reconstruction work in Iraq. Companies from France, Germany, and Russia in particular have been banned. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
French diplomats say they are taking their case to the World Trade Organization. The Pentagon decision Tuesday to exclude certain countries from $18 billion worth of work in Iraq may be illegal, they say. A German spokesman called the decision unacceptable. Russia's defense minister repeated that his country was unlikely to forgive Iraq's $8 billion debt, as Washington would like. Analysts are now questioning what seems an about-face on Washington's part. Relations across the Atlantic had been getting warmer after bitter pre-war splits. Washington was asking France, Germany, and Russia to provide reconstruction money and forgive Iraq's important debts. Now diplomats say it will be more difficult for their countries to help out if their companies are being punished. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
A special tribunal will be set up in Iraq to try former members of the Iraqi leadership, including ousted President Saddam Hussein, for crimes against humanity. NPR's Ivan Watson has more from Baghdad.
Some of the council members announced that this would show to the world the horror of the crimes committed against the Iraqi people, and they said that the tribunal would be able to try Saddam Hussein, even if he is in absentia. A number of top-ranking officials from the U.S. top 55 most wanted Iraqis are in U.S. custody. In theory, those people could be brought to trial.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The Pentagon says two American soldiers were killed today by a roadside bomb near the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. An Air Force cargo plane was also forced to return to the international airport at Baghdad after it was hit while taking off by a ground-fired missile. In stocks, the Dow lost 1.5 points to close at 99.21. The Nasdaq was down 3 points to 1904. This is NPR News. A Florida smoker has lost a lawsuit that sought to hold two big tobacco companies liable for the smoker's lung cancer. Emmett Hall accused R.J. Reynolds and Brown and Williamson of concealing the dangers of smoking. A jury in Tampa found in favor of the tobacco companies, who said that Hall continued to smoke even though he was well aware it was damaging his health. In Oslo, Norway today, Nobel Peace Prize winner Shireen Ebadi addressed human rights abuses throughout the world. NPR's Devar Ardalan reports from Oslo.
Surrounded by her family and friends and addressing the world, Shireen Ebadi said she hopes this Nobel Peace Prize will inspire Iranians and nationals of Islamic states to strive for human rights and democracy. In a dramatic gesture, Shireen Ebadi raised her right arm and said, "I am an Iranian, a descendant of Cyrus the Great, the very emperor who proclaimed he would not reign over the people if they did not wish it. He would not force any person to change his religion and faith and guaranteed freedom for all. Abadi said the people of Iran have been battling between tradition and modernity for over 100 years. She said today many Iranians seek to go forth in step with world developments and not lag behind the caravan of civilization, development, and progress. Devar Ardalan, NPR News, Oslo.
Utility crews in Iraq are working to restore power after a massive blackout hit most of the country. The U.S. administration says about 80% of the electricity has been turned back on, with priority given to hospitals, water, and sewage plants. So far, there's been no information about the cause of the outage, which reportedly started in a power line north of Baghdad. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, has written a new book that he knows will be controversial inside and outside the American Jewish community. In The Fate of Zionism, he writes, "I shall be making the case for Zionism not as a Zionist zealot or even as a critical adherent, but as a disciple of the founders of the movement. I shall look through their eyes at their vision of themselves and at the fundamental question they faced again and again. How could they make peace with the Arabs?" Arthur Hertzberg is the former president of the American Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Policy Foundation and former vice president of the World Jewish Congress. He's a professor emeritus of religion at Dartmouth and a visiting professor of humanities at NYU. He recently won a National Jewish Book Award for his memoir, A Jew in America, which was published last year. I asked him about the form of Zionism he supports.
I'm not a messianist. I do not believe that Zionism is essentially a religious movement preparing the way for the coming of the Messiah. I believe that Zionism was founded, modern Zionism, essentially by two people who didn't agree with each other, but agreed more than they were aware of. One, of course, was Theodor Herzl, who argued that the Jewish people in Europe towards the end of the 19th century was in deep trouble and growing trouble from anti-Semitism, and therefore it needed to reconcentrate itself, or at least a large part of itself, in its own home, preferably in Palestine. And Herzl argued that that reconcentration would dampen down and perhaps end anti-Semitism.
What was the other strain of Zionism?
The other strain of Zionism is associated with the name of a great writer and distinguished thinker named Asher Ginsberg, who wrote under the pen name Ahad Ha'am. He said, one of the people, Ahad Ha'am insisted that Jews in the modern era were running out of steam religiously. The intelligentsia was more and more secularized, and so there was great danger of assimilation, which was all around him. Remember, the late 19th, early 20th century is the era of vast losses to the Jewish people by younger intellectuals who go into the general culture, try to assimilate into it. And so Ahad Ha'am proposed that the Jews needed to reconcentrate their energies in their own homeland where they could encounter the questions of modernity in their own terms. They could face the future thinking it through by the light of their own tradition, not slavishly, but as modern people. The upshot is, therefore, that Zionism is, as it was conceived 100 years or so ago, modern Zionism is a secular movement to solve two problems, the problem of the Jews, of anti-Semitism, and the problem of Judaism, that is, the modernization of Judaism into the contemporary age.
You say that you oppose messianic Zionism.
Yeah.
When
right.
do you think the messianic strain of Zionism entered into the equation?
Well, after the Six-Day War, in June of 67, when the Jews suddenly possessed not a very small piece or a relatively small piece of the land of Israel. Suddenly they were in charge of the West Bank. They were in charge of the Sinai Peninsula. They were very much the masters of the region on the morrow of the Six-Day War. Messianic dreams were re-evoked, and especially in the hearts and minds of some of the religious. Even the secular Jews, or many of them, imagined that this was a sign from heaven that a great, great change was going to happen in the situation, the destiny of the Jewish people. But I was at a meeting with David Ben-Gurion.
He was one of the people who led the war for independence in the late 40s.
And not one of the people. He was prime minister. He was regarded commonly, even by his enemies, as the George Washington of Israel. Very, very great, somewhat difficult man. Now, David Ben-Gurion got up at this meeting, and he said, in words of one syllable, unmistakably, Zionism is not about this. Zionism is not about victory. Zionism is not about messianism. Zionism is about making the Jewish people as safe as possible in a bad time, in a difficult century. And he shocked his audience, and he made me think for 2 years until I woke up one day and said, you know, the man is right.
Well, you also say that he said that unless Israel gave back all the territory that it had captured in the war, with the exception of Jerusalem, it would be heading for historic disaster.
That is what David Ben-Gurion said. I listened. It was hard listening, but I walked away from it saying, if this great man is saying this, and he knows more about it than anyone, then what's going on? And I finally came to the conclusion that he was right.
Why?
That we had to save Zionism from the messianic pretensions of some of the Zionists.
Why do you think he was right?
Well, let me quote one of his immediate successors, Levi Eshkol, the man who was in charge during the Six-Day War. Levi Eshkol used to say, let's begin at the end. Let me begin at the end. We now have Israel in control of the undivided land of Israel to this day. That therefore means that there is already in the undivided land of Israel, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, there is a near majority of Arabs. Now, official Israeli statistics say that it's about 43, 45, 55, and that we are still about 20 years away before the Arab birth rate swamps the Jewish majority. This isn't true. It is being whispered in very knowledgeable circles that the books have been cooked a little bit, and that at this particular moment, we are maximally 7 years away from an Arab majority. Let us therefore, that is, if the land is not divided into two states, that therefore means that Israel has very few options. If we are to preserve the notion that there be a Jewish state for the Jews and a Palestinian state for the Palestinians, we must move very rapidly towards cooling down the quarrel and towards partition.
I want to get back to the idea of a religious justification for the state of Israel and for Zionism as opposed to a purely political and safety justification for it. You're a rabbi, yet you don't
absolutely.
Yet you don't think Israel should be using a religious justification for
absolutely not.
Why not?
if our justification for being there is that God sent us, then the Arab justification, the Islamic justification, is that the Quran has said that any land to which the Quran spread is inalienable. It's Dar al-Islam. That therefore means that we are in a permanent religious quarrel. It's our absolute against their absolute. If you are in a religious quarrel, you cannot compromise. The only compromises that can be made are compromises which are made in secular terms by secular politicians. I would like, if with your permission, to add a little story. Some years ago, I was debating these issues with probably the most brilliant of the Palestinian and the wisest of the Palestinian intellectuals, an old gentleman named Walid Khalidi, who now lives in retirement in Boston. The debate was at the cathedral, the National Cathedral in Washington. And Walid got up and said, I am perfectly, in a rather feline way, he said, I am perfectly prepared to believe that speaking in Hebrew, God promised the land of Israel to the Jews. But I never heard him say it in Arabic in his person as Allah. Now, so long as we're going to insist that we have a religious right to the land of Israel, then even Jimmy Carter will tell us that that isn't what his Southern Baptist teaching has taught him. The Jews have a religious right to the land of Israel, provided they turn Christian. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his national security advisor and is very Catholic, will say, yes, the Jews have a religious right to the land of Israel, provided they accept Christ. Therefore, let's get out of the religious issue.
My guest is Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. His new book is called The Fate of Zionism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. His new book is called The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. Since you obviously feel strongly that Israel and the Palestinians need a two-state solution and they need to arrive at a way of doing that quickly, mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think of the Geneva Accord, which is the peace plan that was negotiated through unofficial channels. Do you think that that's a workable plan?
It's not workable. It's the dream of the end of days. The Geneva solution, and by the way, I'm speaking of friends of mine. Yossi Beilin is a very good friend. I don't know Abdel Rabo as well, but I've known him for years. They are eager, desperate to make peace, and so they have produced a plan which tells us what peace would look like. They have not produced a plan which sits on the militant Palestinians and makes them stop killing people. They have not produced a plan which has any hope of sitting on the militant Israelis and asking them to cut it out, to stop being being rough and making war against the Palestinians. And therefore, until we get to the intermediate stages of how is all of this going to come about, we're not really there. And therefore, I argue in my book that we must first persuade the Americans, the American government, American leadership, to put enormous pressure on both the Israelis and the Palestinians to rein in their vehement and angry people. And once that is done, we can talk of a two-state solution.
What are the odds of America taking that much of an active role in negotiating a peace and then enforcing a peace? Because you're talking about America seeing to it that hardliners on the Israeli side cool off and that suicide bombings stop on the Palestinian side. You know, what are the odds of America being quite that active in a peace plan?
I think in the short run, there aren't very large odds. Because Bush is campaigning for the second term, and he wants to pick up some more hardline Jewish votes. But after that campaign is over, whoever wins it, and, you know, the present presumption is that Bush will, there is going to have to be a change for at least one reason. It is an open secret that there is an awful lot of atomic junk or quasi-atomic junk in or near the Holy Land. If we are to save the world from an explosion somewhere, let's say near the shore of the Mediterranean, we have to do it. Because if we, the Americans, do not do it, there will be hell to pay. And therefore, I think this is becoming ever more clearly a common danger, not only to Jews and Arabs, but to America.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. He has a new book called The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. You were, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you were a founding member of the Israeli group Peace Now.
Yeah.
How has your thinking changed about how to bring about a peace since the group was founded in, what, the late 60s?
Well, very fundamentally, contrary to most of my friends who are still in the peace process, I sometimes mock it as the peace industry, I have lost hope that Israelis and Palestinians can actually not negotiate. They can negotiate. Abdul Rabo and Yossi Beilin proved that they could negotiate the dream. But I have lost hope that they can enforce it. Since Arafat has no intention of putting the screws on Hamas and Hezbollah, etc., since Sharon's government would fall if he really seriously began to withdraw from serious settlements in the West Bank, I am no longer hopeful that Israel and the Palestinians can make a deal, not unless the Americans put major pressure on.
You are a former president of the American Jewish Congress and a former vice president of the World Jewish Congress. I think it's fair to say that you have been a longtime leader of the American, you know, mainstream Jewish leadership. Fair to say?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the American mainstream Jewish leadership has affected the position of Israel on a peace for the future?
Well, there are two levels of American Jewish leadership right now. There are those who want to maintain their reputation in Jerusalem as regulars, and therefore they will swallow a bit or a lot and defend the existing government of Israel. And then, after they get through making the statements on one of NPR's programs or Lord knows where else, they call up somebody and they say, you know, I agree with you. Therefore, the American Jewish community is split within itself. I think it's fair to say right now that the majority want one or the other of the peace proposals. They are afraid to say that the only way to get the peace proposal is to put some pressure on both parties, because they have been taught that this is a no-no. I don't believe that this is a no-no. I believe that we, as part of the Jewish people, have a responsibility to worry about the future along with the Israeli leadership. And I do not believe that all wisdom resides in the Prime Minister's office.
The Bush administration has advocated the so-called roadmap for peace, which is a process to get back on track with the peace talks. Do you think that that's a good plan? Is that something that you're behind?
Again, the question is, who is going to police the bad guys? All of these plans sound good and true and beautiful and hopeful. They fall on their faces when we ask the very pointed question, who is going to make sure that the bad guys don't have money, they don't have arms, and they keep their promises? And rather than center on the bad guys among the Palestinians, I'm going to evoke an awful lot of telephone calls to your program by centering on the bad guys among the Israelis. It is simply not true that the Israelis signed on to the roadmap on the idea that if the Palestinians behaved themselves, they would pull back from the territories. These two promises or these two principles are not linked. The Israelis signed on to pull back from the territories quite without reference to what the Palestinians were about to do. Remind anyone in the Jewish community of this, and the screams begin. But let them read the roadmap.
So you're saying that the Israelis haven't upheld their end of the bargain?
Neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis.
Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg is the author of the new book, The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Hyatt Hotels and Resorts and the American Express Card, taking people home for the holidays. Information available at Hyatt.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, a book about the search for faith, leadership, and community by Stephen Fried. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, author of The Fate of Zionism, and Dr. Eric Gomar of Doctors Without Borders tells us about setting up an AIDS clinic in a poor South African township. When he started the clinic, the South African government was challenging whether HIV causes AIDS.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. His new book is called The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. This year, he won a National Jewish Book Award for his memoir, A Jew in America. Hertzberg is a former president of the American Jewish Congress and is now a visiting professor of humanities at NYU and a professor emeritus of religion at Dartmouth. You're no longer a member of a peace group for the Middle East, but you have just joined another group, and this is called the Clergy Leadership Network. This is a group within the United States.
Ah, you noticed that.
And
yes, go ahead.
What are the goals of this group?
Essentially to suggest that American religion, and remember, I have not been only in Jewish affairs, I've been in American affairs. All my life I was very heavily involved in race, in Vietnam, etc. The function of this group is being created in order to make the point that American religion is not right-wing religion. In other words, to deny the notion that when you say religion in America, you mean ultra-right versions of religion.
When President Bush refers to his faith in talking about Iraq or in talking about another, you know, a step his administration is taking. As a rabbi, how do you feel about it?
Very negatively. And may I quote him, the greatest of all the Republicans. There came to Abraham Lincoln in the middle of the Civil War a delegation of clerics who told him that God was on his side. And Abraham Lincoln responded by saying, I am much more worried as to whether I am on God's side. Let me put it this way. Mr. Bush has had, by now, innumerable prayer breakfasts. Almost without exception, the rabbis he has invited to them are orthodox and politically right-wing. None of the people who are on the other side have, to my knowledge, ever been asked. Now, I think that George Bush has politicized religion, and the effort that I am part of is the attempt to redress the balance.
When you look to the future, I know that you think that there will be no real peace until the United States intervenes in a forceful way.
Right.
However, when you look a few years down the line, past the Sharon-Arafat generation of leaders, do you feel any more hope?
Yeah. What gives me hope is the appearance of a few people on the Palestinian side, Abdurrabbo Sari Nusseibeh, who I gather, by the way, is likely to be here by Thursday, and the appearance on the Israeli side, not only of Yossi Beilon, whom we've known a long time, and he happens to be a very dear friend of mine, but, even though we disagree at the moment, but the appearance of the last four heads of Israel's Secret Service, who said jointly that what Israel is doing may be tactically useful, but is a strategic disaster. I think a new generation is beginning to show up, which is thinking outside the box. I was at the Council on Foreign Relations the other day when Abdurrabbo and Beilon spoke. And I was reduced to tears by Abdurrabbo, who said, I am here because I have lived all my life as a refugee. I don't want my children to continue with it, and certainly not my grandchildren. And I gulped. And I think it is that gulp which is the hope.
Why did you gulp? Why did that get to you?
Why did that get to me? Because I have children and grandchildren. because I was 5 years old when I was brought to this country after running away from the kids in the Ukrainian parochial school in the town of my birth, who chased me up the block to beat me up because they had just discovered that I was a Christ killer, etc. I know what it means to be a refugee, and I don't want it to happen, not again and again, to anyone else.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg is the author of the new book, The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. Coming up, setting up a pilot project for treating people with AIDS in South Africa. This is Fresh Air. South Africa is at the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic. More than 10% of the population is infected. 600 people die of AIDS every day there. But until recently, the government has refused to provide access to antiretroviral drugs, challenging the safety and effectiveness of the drugs, and questioning whether AIDS was caused by HIV. My guest, Dr. Eric Gomar, started a pilot project in Khayelitsha, a poor township outside of Cape Town, where his staff provides these drugs to people with AIDS. He hopes to show that the treatment is effective and that people who are poor and uneducated can comply with the drug regimen. Dr. Gomar heads the South African mission of Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French name, Médecins Sans Frontières. He chose Khayelitsha as the location for his clinic because local authorities there had already defied the government by creating a program giving drugs to pregnant women with AIDS to prevent transmitting the virus to their babies. Last year, the magazine Scientific American named Dr. Gomar Medical Policy Leader of the Year. I asked him how AIDS had already affected Khayelitsha when he started his program.
When I first went to Khayelitsha, that was mid-99, I used to go there every day, forcing myself to go. I had no program. There was nothing, strictly nothing, happening around HIV/AIDS, hardly even any test done. Nobody was speaking about it. It was a taboo. You were not meant to speak about it. And my first and strongest enemy were the nurses, in fact, of the health staff, because they were telling me, "No, doctor, sorry, it's impossible to set up an HIV clinic. All people here will never queue in front of your door. You don't imagine the stigma."
Wait, so nurses were telling you don't even bother to set up a clinic because HIV is such a stigma, no one's going to come?
Yes, of course. Nurses were extremely negative about it. They didn't want at all me to open in a clinic because we opened a clinic inside existing day hospitals. So it was a mix of denial, not saying, "No, all people will never, ever queue in front of your door because they are not ready to accept that they are HIV." And something I discovered later, it was also a mix of their own fear. They had the impression, in fact, that I would bring to them a lot of HIV-positive people, and I was telling them, "But they are here around already. They are among your patients. You just do not know that they are HIV-positive."
So was part of what the nurses were afraid of catching the disease themselves because you'd be bringing in more infected people?
Definitely. Contamination was a fear. Mm-hmm. But much worse than that, this terrible stigma around HIV. HIV and AIDS are them. We are health staff. We're all uniform, with all privilege. You see, you try, when you are in a terrible situation, you see the boat sinking, you try to reestablish classes. We are in the Titanic here, and the first class doesn't want to mix with the third class because there's just not enough room on the safety boats. The good success we had, this was beginning of last year, 2002, is that the first nurse came to the clinic, in fact, inside her own clinic where everybody knows her, and begged for help. She's now perfectly well. She's back to work. And she's, of course, our best argument and advocate against stigmatization.
Now, if AIDS was such a stigma in the township where you set up your clinic, how did you convince people who weren't on the medical staff, the greater part of the population, how did you convince them to show up for help if they needed it?
Well, it was very simple. Numbers are killing the stigma. People are desperate to get some form of treatment. They don't want to die. So you always find people who are ready to go if, of course, in exchange, coming out positive, they receive a service, which was not at all the case before. And then, you know, it builds up, and the number builds up, and suddenly people realize that it's not dozens, it's not hundreds, it's thousands. Only in Khayelitsha, this township, 500,000 inhabitants, we estimate we have between 60 and 70,000 people HIV positive. It's big numbers. They start to, nowadays, you see everywhere in the street people wearing T-shirts, HIV positive. It's even fashionable to wear those things. I think numbers make an enormous difference, and numbers bring in a different power balance and forced acceptation.
One of the things you've had to do at the clinic is to give people drugs, antiretroviral drugs. Those are expensive drugs. Those are drugs that were particularly difficult to come by in South Africa. What has your technique been for getting drugs in an affordable enough way so that you could give them or sell them, you could tell me which it is, to the sick people at your clinic?
Yes, we don't sell them. We give them for free, and we believe it's important they are free. But you are totally right. So it was a very tricky situation. In that time, I remember, 99 here in South Africa, it costed $6,000 per year per patient, triple therapy. Okay? There's no way the South African government would have been able to afford it. And from the beginning, we said we will drop the price dramatically, and there was only one way to do so. It was by provoking competition. And the only way to provoke competition when you have exclusive patent holder is to bring in generic copies of that drug. We wrote to the patent holder, that was beginning of 2000, to each of the patent holder, Glaxo, Boehringer, saying, we, no one of our client is able to afford your drug, so we intend to bring in generics. Please tell us if you would consider this as a patent infringement. And of course, we were flooded by letter of answers saying this will be considered as a patent infringement.
So once they told you it would be a patent violation for you to import generic drugs, what did you do?
Well, we were first very nervous about it, but we decided that we would do it and we'll let the world know that we would do it. They didn't dare to sue us. They didn't dare to sue us because in the meantime, MSF and other groups, TAC here locally, and several groups in the United States, extremely active, like ACT UP and TAG, had made huge effort to explain the situation, to explain that there is no way the huge majority of people affected by AIDS will one day be treated if there is no access to generic, to bring the price down. And as a result, we were never, ever sued.
So where do you get the generics from?
Initially from Brazil, because we wanted to get them from a state-controlled company that could give us. We wanted to make sure they would be at costing price. And the only one who accepted to give us the breakdown of price was a Brazilian. So we imported from Brazil, and as a result, it costed us exactly for a triple therapy, $1.08 per day. So it makes it more or less 360, a bit more 360 per year, down from $6,000. You see the difference?
That's per person.
purposeness.
Yeah, very big difference.
It's a big difference, definitely. Nowadays, we have worked on different other scenario. We still import some from Brazil. We import some from India. The ultimate goal, of course, was to get a local production because we were convinced that it would certainly change the president's mind if instead of paying in US dollars every month a huge check, because inevitably it would be a huge check, if this could be produced locally, paid in rand, and create jobs, it might change his mind. And as a matter of fact, as I'm speaking to you, it has started now. The first antiretroviral is produced here close to Port Elizabeth by a company called Aspen Pharmacare. And, of course, we use it.
I know that one of the biggest concerns about distributing antiretroviral drugs to people who are poor and uneducated is that they might have difficulty complying with a complicated regimen. There are several drugs you have to take in the AIDS antiretroviral regimen. They have to be taken at the same time every day. So what have some of the problems, have you had problems with compliance in the township in South Africa where you work?
Yes, we have had problem of compliance for the good reason that compliance is not an easy issue. But generally said, we have been completely surprised by the fact that the result we achieved here were, as a matter of fact, much better than everything you read published on court in the United States. Why so? The first reason is a social reason. We deal with a less problematic population. We deal in great majority with mothers, their child, their partners, who are trying, with difficulty of course, to build a family. We don't deal like in a large proportion in Western countries with IV drug users, with prostitutes. Here, HIV/AIDS, it's part of the environment. It's everybody. It's normal. So first reason, I would say a social reason. Second reason, people are very aware that they have an extraordinary chance to benefit from those drugs, and they won't have a second one. And I can tell you that they stick religiously to their treatment because they know very well, contrary to impression again we can have in the West, that if they miss that chance, they won't have another one. And the third reason is probably the most powerful. You know, the young generation in Europe doesn't see anymore their peers, their friend, their colleague dying. Here, I can tell you, people still die on a daily basis. The main activity is to go to a funeral every single Saturday. So they know very well each time one brings someone in terminal stage in the waiting room, like it happened again this morning, everybody look at each other and say, I'm going to take my pills. So I think that's what's making the difference.
My guest is Dr. Eric Gomar. He's the head of mission in South Africa for Doctors Without Borders. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Eric Gomar, and he's Doctors Without Borders' head of mission in South Africa, where he set up a clinic to treat people with HIV/AIDS You estimate that about 25% of the population in the township where you work is HIV positive. A lot of people are dying of AIDS where you are. Do you see the evidence of that in day-to-day life?
Oh, for sure. You see this evidence in the fact that this township is, for the moment, getting poorer and poorer. HIV strikes mainly the middle-aged population, the economically active. Once you have someone sick in your family, the African tradition forces you to take care of the sick. And whatever means you have, you are obliged to give all your means for the sick. So, I mean, we are surrounded by people on a daily basis. I have certainly 10 or 15 people coming to collect money for the funerals of this or to pay the drugs of that one. It has completely changed the life of a township. And as a result, you see kids dropping from school. You see nurses stopping their job so that they can get what they call a package. It means their pension money to be able to pay for drugs for their partner or for the children who are sick.
I don't know where else you've worked for Doctors Without Borders, but have you ever been surrounded by as much death as you've seen in the township of South Africa where you're based?
Yes, because I've worked for 22 years with the MSF, so I've seen more dramatic war situation like in Chechnya or refugee situation like in Kisangani or Eastern Congo, where I've counted a much higher number of dead, but there's a big difference. When you have in the morning dozens of deaths on the ground, in fact, you don't know them. So you are not shocked the same way. When you deal with HIV/AIDS patients, you know all of them because they are chronic patients. They come regularly, and each death is much more difficult to assume.
How are you personally dealing with all the deaths that you're seeing, deaths in many cases of people who you know?
Of course, I have ups and downs, like every single caregiver. We have a very strong team, a team made out of counselors, nurses, and a few doctors. In fact, we have three clinics here in Khayelitsha. We've known individuals, a lot of individuals who have passed away. They're always young, less than 20 years most of the time, looking at you in the hope you're going to save them. And then, well, when you don't succeed, of course, you feel suddenly extremely lonely and ashamed. But the best way to cope with it is share it with the team, and that's what we do.
Do you have a lot of people who come to you hoping that they could get treatment, but their AIDS is too advanced to be helped by the antiretrovirals?
Yes. It's very common because now the rumor has spread, and we have people who traveled hundreds of kilometers. Last week, the young lady who had traveled, I've calculated, 1,800 kilometers. She was weighing 32 kilos, and most probably TB, totally out of breath, totally anemic. She was literally dying on the table. She had done that in desperate, and you imagine the condition of transport. She had done in despair 1,800 kilometers because she thought that's the only place where she could be saved. And she passed away the same night.
That must have been rough. Did she have family with her?
Yes, her mother was with her.
So then her mother had to make that long trip back alone.
Yes, unfortunately. But I would say to that, that never, since I've been working here, never felt any sense of anger against us.
Mm-hmm.
We mourn that death with the mother, and, you know, she looked at me and said, well, we, in her words, of course she wasn't speaking English, but something like, we have done what we could. And, you know, the huge majority of people living with HIV in this country, and again, there are 5 million, do not expect to be saved. In fact, a lot of them know very well that they will not be saved because this is almost an impossible task. But people are extremely sensitive and all what they want in the name of what they fought for under apartheid, their definition nowadays of democracy, like Nelson Mandela was saying in a concert Saturday, is to be given a right to be seen, to be treated, as long as you have tried and tried with all your means to do something. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But if you haven't tried, you are not entitled to be part of that democracy.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your program.
It was a pleasure, and thank you for your interest.
Dr. Eric Gomar is head of mission in South Africa for Doctors Without Borders. He spoke to us from Cape Town. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. We're closing with a recording by the Cuban pianist Ruben Gonzalez. He died Monday at the age of 84. Gonzalez was one of the older Cuban jazz musicians who were considered old-fashioned after the revolution. His career was revived and he became popular in the U.S. as a result of Ry Cooter's 1999 documentary, The Buena Vista Social Club. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Meyerowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members, Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. And from Nonesuch Records, featuring composer Thomas Newman's soundtrack for the film version of Angels in America, a two-part, six-hour event presentation on HBO. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa!
That's right. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Jones. He has a CD of old and new recordings. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose.